This is an interview with Peter Cacciavite. We are in New Haven, Connecticut, at Yale University, in Davenport College, actually. And it's December 14th, 1999, and we will be discussing Namibia. I'll put this here. For the record, Mr. Cacciavite, would you just explain for us where you were born and where you were educated, and when you first became involved in independence movement for Namibia?
Yes, I was born many years ago in a place called Okahandja in the center of Namibia. It's about a 1 hour's drive from Windhoek to the north of Windhoek, and that's my hometown. I grew up in that area. Initially, I went to school in Okahandja at a missionary run school, and then I moved from Okahandja to Windhoek, where I more or less finished my primary school education. I went to high school, the only high school where many of us many of us met from different parts of Namibia, from the south, from the west, from the east, from the north. That's where I went to school in the early 60s. It was originally a missionary-run school, which was dedicated to training teachers. The school, in fact, was transferred from a place called Ochimbingwe in 1890 to Okahandja, because Okahandja was always the center of the country, and eventually, I think after the Second World War, if I'm right, the South African Army took over the school formally, and became the Augustinian Government Training College. So I was there along with other young men and women of my generation.
And it turned out to be a very important place because the foreign minister, Theo Bengurga, went there. I don't know.
Everybody.
Did Sam Nujoma go to school there?
No, he didn't.
He didn't.
No, but it was really the place where most of us went to.
Okay.
The majority of the people today in responsible positions in government and everywhere are a product of that particular school. It was the training ground for many of us in terms of being politically aware. We learn a great deal about learn from each other, and I think we became what they call agitators, political agitators, in terms of being conscious of the fact that the regime which governed Namibia then basically was imposed in dictated rather than consulted, and we on our part also became politically aware, and we were involved in some of the initial demonstrations and marches, we were in touch with people outside the country who helped to awaken us, help us to become more and more aware of the fact that we needed to fight for our independence. So really that formed every part of my, and while we were there, we became politically aware, and I think it was a year later, I think that was 60, 61, 62, I became a member of SWAPO. We were actively involved in, as part of the youth movement, help organize things, do a lot of lobby work in terms of mobilizing support for the party.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, at the time that SWAPU was organized, mm-hmm. there was another organization, SWANU.
Of course, SWANU, yes, SWANU. Yes.
And yet eventually the OAU recognized SWAPU as the sole representative mm-hmm. of the Indian mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. Why did that happen? I mean, why was SWANU not recognized in that same way?
I think it due to several factors, mainly like the case of Namibia, other countries like Mozambique, Angola, Zimbabwe, South Africa, they had more than one nationalist organization. Mm-hmm. And it was not easy for them, basically. Initially, they had to open their doors to all of them, mm-hmm. hear them out, yeah. listen to them, and understand exactly what programs they were proposing as far as advancing the liberation struggle in their respective countries. We all have to go through particular tests. You have a training program for your men to go for military training, and then to come back and to go and organize the resistance in the country. So, but over a period, it became very clear that not all the nationalist organizations were equipped in the same way and were determined not only to preach, but concretely demonstrate that they have something to do in terms of mobilizing their people and organizing a resistance within the country. Now, I think that it was on that basis that eventually SWAPU was able to gain the recognition of the OAU.
Yeah.
And initially it sounded as if, well, political parties, movements do compete for influence, for power. But I think for us, I'm talking as an actor now, someone who was in the middle of some of those things,
yeah.
I look upon that as having been a heavy responsibility for the movement. After my initial stay in Tanzania and in Nigeria for purpose of going to school there, eventually I became the representative of SWAPU in the United Kingdom,
right,
responsible
right.
for Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I look upon the eventual recognition of SWAPU as having been a challenge to the leadership of the party, and to those of us on the ground who have to implement the decisions of the party or of the MUMU movement. It did not mean that SWAPU as a movement was working against the aspirations of other Namibian nationalist organizations.
Mm-hmm.
It meant that we were given the recognition, recognize out of the hard work we have been able to show, but it meant that we also have to carry a responsibility for the rest of the Namibian exile community in terms of providing scholarships, in
yeah.
terms of helping them, in terms of opening doors for them as well.
Right. What age were you when you left Namibia, and why did you finally decide to have to leave the country?
I was part of a group of young men who I think we were early 20s, who became active within the party in SWAPU, and through our contacts, particularly in the United States, got to know that if we were able to make our way all the way to Tanganyika, Dar es Salaam, we would have access to scholarships from the United Nations.
Really?
Yes. And in fact, we had a Namibian, the first Namibian to leave the country into exile, Dr. Mbumba Kerina, was in the United States, having been over here since 1957. In fact, he's got an interesting history, because I think he gained acceptance in terms of been legally accepted here through the intervention of JFK, who took on his case as early as that, as a congressman or something like that. He wrote to us and said, well, this is what you should do. And he was going to organize some scholarships for us to come to the U.S. I think I had this kind of dream of going to Stanford University. So for young people, as of that sort of generation, it was very exciting. But it was also part of the freedom movement to leave the country, to acquire the necessary qualifications in being trained, and also to continue the gospel of mobilizing support for the Namibian cause internationally, and eventually hopefully returning.
Right.
And I worked out that I would be away from home for about 5 years. That time when we eventually left at the end of 1962,
uh-huh.
We were hoping that I could be away maybe for about 5 years and hopefully return. So of course we left indeed. It took quite a long time to find our way through Botswana, through the Kalahari Desert, over into Botswana, Gaborone, eventually Mfasistan, and through southern Rhodesia by train, and the journey was not smooth. In fact, I left your Ben Gurira and Benalas in Mfasistan when we left, and he decided to help me to bring my suitcase eventually to Bulawayo, where we were supposed to meet in the evening. We left early in the morning because the three of us did not have legal documents, so we have to go through the bush. You go by train all the way to the border, and before you could cross over, we got off the train and walked through the bushes and so on, and eventually we got arrested. And your Ben Rudolph came later in the afternoon by a train, because he had a document that said that he was a worker from Yasaland, and he was being expelled. I mean, basically asked to return home. That's how he was able to go through without any particular difficulty. But that shows you he was quite a smart guy, even as early as that.
As early as that, a smart guy. Interesting. That's fantastic. So then I wanted to get to the role that you played in England when you were the representative there.
I was sent by President Semenyoma in 1968, initially to set up a swap office, a base, from where to lobby the British government, British Parliament, European political parties, church groups. It was at the time when a group of Namibians were being trialed in Pretoria, including the Honorable Yatwewo and others who were just about to be sent to Robben Island and so on.
Yeah.
So my job was there to raise the plight and focus attention of the international community on issues concerning Namibian prisoners.
Okay.
And then I continue thereafter to basically build a solidarity support for SWAPO, for Namibia, and generally raise the profile of our movement SWAPO within Western New European countries. That meant working with the Labour Party, the Liberal Party, the Conservative Party, particularly in the UK, worked with colleagues from other movements like the ANC, ZAPU, ZANU, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I was the youngest member, head of the Liberation Movement Office in the United Kingdom. I worked with our friends from the ANC, including the present president Thabo Mbeki. He was part of the youth league of the ANC then, and also an activist within the ANC movement. So I did that from 1968 to 1977. I look upon my record during that time as being a distinguished one. I was very hard. I used to run a newsletter. I used to maintain links with the home front. A great deal of work went through the London office, keep the INSWAPO leadership inside the country informed, share with them the decision being taken at the United Nations, share with them what INSWAPO as a movement was trying to do, build up a strong diplomatic front generally. So my job was basically to ensure that we continuously kept the leadership in the country in form, but at the same time build a network of support in a number of Western European capitals, London, Paris, Geneva, Bonn, and so forth.
Now, I wanted to ask you, because you were following Europe and what was going on there, initially, what was the attitude of the UK towards the problems that you were having in South Africa? Because my understanding was that the UK was basically supportive of South Africa.
Interesting. But you have to remember, United Kingdom is a fascinating society. Historically, very close to Pretoria. Mm-hmm. Politically, having been the godfather of the regime in Southern Africa,
sure, yeah.
South Africa, Southern Rhodesia, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we knew that there was a strong opinion in that country which was equally opposed to racist regimes in Southern Africa. It meant that both, you know, SWAPO, our friends in the ANC, we have to work very hard to get through to the leadership of the Labour Party or the Liberal Party.
Okay.
We build a solid support at the party political level. Around that time, of course, you know that the Labour Party was in power. There was a Conservative Party. There were changes. But around about the time when things were hotting up, when the war was escalating in Southern Africa, the Labour Party was in power. The Foreign Minister, David Owen, was a very accessible person who was quite eager to make a mark. Within the United States, we had we had the Democratic Party in power under Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, right.
And as soon as they came to power, Andrew Young, who was the new ambassador to the United Nations, was dispatched to go in and talk to members of the Liberation Movement. I had a meeting with him in London.
Oh, dear.
At the U.S. Embassy, quietly.
Okay.
And I always remember his words. He said he was representing the U.S. President, Jimmy Carter. They wanted to do something, bearing in mind his own background, where he comes from as one of the leaders of the civil,
civil
rights movement.
Yeah.
And basically he conveyed his own sentiments about that they wanted to be partners in searching for a solution in Southern Africa. But of course also very anti-communist in the sense that there was this kind of perception that the liberation movements from Southern Africa were, you know, close to Soviet Union, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, if that is the case, this is going to prove very difficult for us to do to be associated with people who are, you know, close to the other side. And mm-hmm. I explained to them, Honorable Andrew Young, and I said, ours is a struggle for life and death. You have to put yourself in our position. We are not fighting to liberate Southern Africa, to replace Southern Africa with anything else other than that we want our people to have to be able to partake in self-determination process to achieve our independence. And we appreciate the conduct we were making, and let's build on that. Okay. Now, that was the beginning of the United Kingdom through the Labour Party government, and the United States through the Jimmy Carter administration, and trying to look for alternative ways of finding solutions. But I wanted to underline, just to add a footnote to that. This is now, as we went on, we had a major crisis in Southern Africa in terms of the escalation of war, tension building up, South Africa being involved in destabilizing the neighboring countries from bombing of Zambia mm-hmm. and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Independence having been won in Mozambique in 1975,
right.
And eventual changes taking place, the coup in Portugal, which brought about changes in its colonies,
right.
Angola being on the way towards independence, the post-Soweto, the Soweto, the kids being rising up in 1976. Mm-hmm. These were the events, basically.
Okay.
And at the international level, the Western countries in the UN Security Council, having been confronted by repeated attempts to push through resolution, calling for sanctions against South Africa. There was arms embargo against South Africa. There were other initiative by the Nalanayan movement. There were all these concerted efforts which push initiative to the UN Security Council,
okay.
Which then invited vetoes from the United States government and other and its Western allies. Now, then from there on, were all these repeated vetoes. It really put the Security Council under pressure. It also, the attacks against Western countries, particularly the United States, France, and Britain. I recall more than once those three countries having jointly used vetoes on more than one occasion. Now, that I feel led to London, Washington, to rethink about what was happening. They could not continue to be defined and to do those things without actually reflecting on the future of the role of the United Nations. So yeah. Then you have the Security Council resolution of 435, which called for a negotiated settlement of the Namibian question, which in my opinion it was a move away from confrontation, both at the security level as well as trying to find a way to an escalating war situation in the region.
So now we had what's been referred to as the Western Five. So that was the U.S. and the U.K. because finally deciding that they had to do something.
Yeah.
And France.
Yeah.
And then Canada and West Germany
yeah.
at the time were both on the Security Council
right.
as
That's
well
right. Right.
during
mm.
that particular
mm.
two-year period.
Mm.
Now, my understanding was that the Western Five wanted to come together to produce a kind of resolution in the Security Council, that was compatible with how they thought about the situation, so that, in a sense, they didn't include the Soviet Union and China in the proposals that they wanted to make. In other words, they had come up with a report, and then that was then introduced to the Security Council. So how did that finally evolve? Because obviously the Soviet Union and China had to get on board because
I remember earlier than that, there was a very innocent resolution. I don't have the details, but an innocent resolution initiated by Al-Jadina, which basically called for UN supervised elections, and there was a question whether SWAPO would be ready to partake in a democratic, free and fair elections and so on. And that resolution went through. That initiative was the forerunner to the Western Five initiative, which called for a negotiating model for Namibia, basically trying to promote a negotiating model as represented by the 435. SWAPO, having said yes to that resolution, which actually was a record, and I think the Western Front built around that initial resolution, which I can't recall the number, but we can find out. Yeah. Now, this there was so that window opening basically led to the Western Five to build on something else. And since basically we're saying, well, we are open to listen to any ideas and to partake in any exercise which is designed to take the United Nations to Namibia, that then was made use of. Now, the 435 became the hopeful option. We were ready. The UN was ready, but the major obstacle was South Africa. This was a diplomatic victory for the Five, and it represented a better solution, a better option. But South Africa, it was too soon for them. They were not ready for that. They were thinking about basically all along a settlement which they can determine in terms of pace, in terms of the scale of UN involvement. So although this was something very constructive, important, we got stuck halfway through because South Africa was not really welcome.
Now, I had mentioned to you a couple of days ago when we were talking about the interview, that I wanted to understand a little bit better about a meeting that took place in Geneva. Now, I looked up the date, and it was actually January of 1981, so it would have been right before Reagan would have been inaugurated on January 20th of 1981. And you had mentioned to me that because it was still within the Carter administration, it was possible for this to take place. So perhaps you
can let me take you through that, because I think what is exciting, before we come to that, there was a final attempt by the Western Five under the leadership of David Owen and the U.S. Secretary of State, our fascinating gentleman from New York, trying to remember his name now. They went to South Africa, and I remember David Owen's own words, to give South Africa a last chance, to say, look, you are holding up things, and we have done our best. Now we want you to play your part. They had a meeting with the South African government leadership, John Foster and the rest. And then they discover that basically South Africa had their own strategy to build up an internal leadership, and to give that leadership a bit of time to compete against SWAPO. Now, even at that point, South Africa was not willing, basically. They didn't say yes or no, but they were saying, well, we have elections coming up in Southwest Africa, as they used to refer to. We have committed ourselves to the internal leadership to go through that election. The Western Five were opposed to that because they said, look, if you do that, the UN is not going to recognize the internal elections. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, South Africa went through with their own arrangements, okay, as opposed to allowing the implementation of 435.
Okay.
Now, now we are still basically in the 1978, we are moving towards the end of the 70s.
Right, okay.
In order to basically to forestall the implementation of 435, the South African army attacked the southern part of Angola, a refugee camp called Kasinga, where a number of people were killed. And they anticipated SWAPO to turn its back on 435. In order to ensure that the blame was not actually pinned on them, but we could not go ahead with the implementation because there you are, you know, SWAPO now has turned its back on the implementation of FIFA. SWAPO denounced, of course, this barbaric attacks on a refugee camp at Kasinga and reaffirmed its commitment to Security Council 435. And that maintained the pressure on them.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, South Africa also discovered that Jimmy Carter's administration was coming to an end.
Mm-hmm.
Ronald Reagan having won that election, it was just a question of time before he takes office. Nevertheless, the Western Five organized a meeting in Geneva quickly to try and to resolve the difference, the gap between Pretoria and the United Nations, to see whether they could sort of accommodate South Africa's fears at the last moment. But basically, that was at the tail end of Carter, our administration, and that meeting in Geneva, in fact, I was there, did not really help resolve the outstanding issues. There were questions of basis, whether in SWAPO's presence in Namibia could be recognized and be addressed in a particular way. There were questions of, this is now the beginning of Bill of Rights, you know, what rights of minorities and issues like that came up as well. So those issues were touched upon, but they were not finally resolved.
They weren't finally resolved,
yes,
but they,
yeah,
but the working paper of that became somewhat important because of the introduction of the Bill of Rights and I believe a recognition of respect for private property and some of the things that not only the ruling party within Namibia was concerned about, but other ethnic groups were concerned about.
Yes, yes, I agree, but I think what I'm trying to say, if those issues were actually addressed and there was a political will to resolve them, it could have been resolved at that May meeting.
Mm-hmm.
But South Africa, knowing the fact that that they could, in terms of the pronouncements by the Republican Party before it came to power, mm-hmm, and the leadership of the party, which is due to take office, they knew that actually they could hold back,
mm-hmm,
and perhaps extract more concessions.
Mm-hmm.
And that is eventually what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Okay, well, that's really important. I know that we have a lot to talk about, but I wanted to sort of jump ahead a little bit. In 1988, things were building up. There was the linkage that had been created to remove the Cuban troops from Angola as a condition for Namibian independence, and talks were really becoming conclusive on that, and by the end of the year 1988, an agreement was made. But during that year, there was tremendous turmoil within Namibia. There had been the boycott of the schools in the north, and then it had spread throughout the country. There was a certain amount of violence, and South African forces and the peace had become very depressive. So was there any coordination between what was going on outside the country and the turmoil that was going on inside the country? They seemed disconnected, but I don't know.
Our people, with the swap leadership in the country, was very much linked within the civil organizations like the churches and other institutions. So they were part and parcel of people who were trying to hold things together. Not so much functioning as a party, but basically as community-based organizations. Running, we had what we call independent schools, which were trying to preserve a bit of decent education and being run by local leadership, by community-based leadership, receiving financial support in different parts of the world, particularly from Norway, from Finland, from Sweden, and so on. Those activities were quite important on the ground. They kept people alive, and they made sure that in areas where the Southern government had decided basically to abandon those people because they were seen to be unredeemable, that they could not be reconciled with the interests of South Africa, they were simply dumped there. No proper services were extended to those areas. So they relied heavily on what the church could provide and what could be externally organized through support and so on. So in the north, in some parts of the north, we had no-go areas where the army have actually destroyed any meaningful community services. And I think around that time, just before the commencement of UNTAC, I think we had a situation where South African Army was now in retreat. The writing was on the wall that they have now finally accepted that they are not going to be in this country. Things were changing. But they, I remember visiting the northern part of the country, accompanying President Sam Nujoma. I was amazed by the destruction to property, what I saw, buildings, which totally wrecked. The roof is gone, the doors are gone, and the toilets and that facility totally destroyed. That happened around about the period you're talking about, to all the way to the arrival of UNTAC and immediately thereafter. You would have seen.
Was it a kind of revenge, or what were they trying to show by doing that?
I think revenge. That there's an anger there. You say that they didn't care. They wanted to leave the place. They are not going to find this place in a workable state.
Okay.
They have to wreck things. They have to make it difficult for the incoming other administration.
And then, to a certain degree, then there were, because of that kind of destruction. And I understand that because they felt some kind of threat to the end of their regime, they became more repressive.
Yeah.
And then in reaction to that, the students couldn't stand it anymore.
Yes.
They just said, we're just not going to go to school in this place which is in such danger.
And also they, the UNTAC is just about to arrive and we are getting what we've been fighting for. I might as well basically not go to school or whatever. Let me do that in the new Namibia. There was that kind of excitement as well. You know, basically, it is worth waiting. I mean, a few months, whatever, it will not make any difference and so on. I mean, again, these are things which, these things were not actually organized by a particular person to let's do that. I think it was a reaction to a
reaction,
exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, all right. It's making a lot more sense. Well, then UNTAG finally got its funding to go, and so things were delayed in terms of the troops arriving, but things started up on April 1st, and then we had the disastrous event that happened April 1st, where there were SWAPO members, some I understand across the border, some already living in the north of Namibia, coming out basically to turn in their weapons, and the conflict, I believe, basically finding them, killing them, and then all this gets represented to Akisari as an incursion of SWAPO across the border, and there's fighting. We need to release the South Africans from their base. So that took place, and then the killing became worse.
Yeah.
Then there was a meeting that took place at Mount Etna on April 9th. And I can't seem to get people to talk about that meeting, and I don't know whether you have any further information about who was there, why did it take place, what happened.
Well, I think the Mount Etna is important in the history of Namibia, and in particular reference to UNTAC's operations. Mount Etna today, I say you are coming to Namibia one of these days, I think it would be nice to visit. We need to, I'm part of my job, apart from being a head of university, I'm also the chairman of the National Monuments Council. I'm interested to look at the landmarks, the historical sites. And, but coming back to Mount Etna, Mount Etna, it was a meeting place where the United Nations, South Africa, and other interested parties convened to address an emergency situation provoked by that particular happening, the attacks unleashed by the South African regime against the returning freedom fighters. First of all, it is a fact that the announcement that the war has come to an end, we're returning to Namibia peacefully to partake in free and fair elections held by the United Nations, really opened the door for many people.
Mm-hmm.
Many of our fighters, members of SWAPO, who were to be found in the southern part of Angola, when they heard that, obviously, some of them were, crossing on their own to find their way, because they are not very far from, it's just... It's like crossing from here to the railway station, So some of them, of course, they instructed that they should report to the nearest whatever, either to the police station or to civil society set up like the church and so on. You hand yourself over. When the South Africans got the wind of this, when they saw these people, of course, it became an excellent opportunity. This is what they've been looking for. So this was presented as SWAPO was their army and bringing armed forces into the country, etc. So I remember partaking in a discussion organized by a number of U.S. congressmen and senators organizing in Switzerland on this particular issue. I was the spokesperson of NSWAP at that meeting.
When did that take place?
I think it was around about June.
Okay.
June, I think.
So after,
yes,
to
yes.
Try to
and
understand
the U.S. had evidence. They had using quite advanced equipment to monitor the movement of people. That was observed from
satellite. Yeah.
And still, I was saying at that particular meeting, that does not explain the intent. People, yes, they're armed, but that should not be used as if the people were invading their country.
Mm-hmm.
You are talking about people who have waited for over 27, 26, 28 years, now returning. So that had to be explained in the context of the peaceful nature. You cannot have people marching into the country like that with intent to fight, open like that.